get off the air, when we got off the airplane into the airport, going to immigration. He said, oh, the concept of beauty is totally different here. And he was talking about weight. Because what is considered to be beautiful here in terms of size, in Africa, we consider to be skinny. You better get some food in your two sides. Because consider if you're big, then you're eating good and you're healthy. So you see the people who are most famous and most respected and this comes considerations of beauty. You see the kings and the queens. They're healthy. they sit in their thrones and they sit in their silence, you know. And they're big, they're spread. Let's consider that they're doing good. That life is good. You're eating nice. And then in America, you know, the models, they work out in the gym, some of them, every day. And they're so particular about, you know, what they eat. You know, sometime back when I was in Los Angeles and I was talking to Cher, and as we ended the conversation, we gave her some Maha sweets from the Los Angeles Temple. And immediately, she took a take. She's wondering how many calories are there. And then I realized that these famous people, especially the entertainers, they have to be so careful about, you know, keeping their bodies fit in terms of what the standard is. Because if not, then society will not look at them, boy. They will not seem to get the fame, you know. I mean, it's just like when Elvis Presley got really fat. He wasn't in the public hardly at all. I mean, just imagine, you know, if Madonna all of a sudden she just sprouted out to 250 pounds, you know. I mean, it just wouldn't be the same. Because for the average person's conception, you know, sensual, sexual, thin, beautiful, and she, you know, do her see gyrating or whatever, she's doing that at 300 pounds. it would quite be the same. So, for them, it's a major part of their life to suffer and trying to, you know, keep the body, you know, see skinny. So how we torture ourselves in trying to improve on our eating, sleeping, bathing, and defending, and trying to help others to be envious of us. Because when you think about it, greatness in material culture means you got so many people envious of you. The more people who are envious of you, you know, the greater you are. It's just, you know, one of the reasons that the Princess Diana was so famous is practically every woman in the world was envious of her. They were thinking, yes, I'd like to live in a palace. I love to have servants, you know, doing everything, putting my shoes on, cleaning my nails, brushing my teeth, you know, then putting, you know, millions of dollars of jewelry on me, and have people have my picture all over the place, you know, in the drive and very royal arrangements, and you know, and it was just like, but it wasn't, you know, so that's there. Envy is a aspect of honoring. You don't envy a homeless person. You feel sad for them. So, one is famous in the material world, material culture. It mainly means, especially Western culture, means you're very individualistic. It means you're very self-centered, usually for materialism, because that's what works, you know, material culture now. Basically what works in Kali Yuga is to be selfish, is to have greed, to be concerned about you, to do whatever you can and use it for you, and to have many people envious of you, because you're great, you're successful, you're famous, you're beautiful, etc. More beautiful someone is, more people would like to be like that, more the envious of that person, more wealth, etc. So this tridatu of kapha, sita, and value is what the body is really made of: mucus, bowel, and air. Now this air, though, is important. It's like I'm noticing with the cancer, I have like shortness of breath. And when cancer seems to be more stronger, more active, it's like the breath is a little shorter, which seems to suggest that the energy level is different and is manifesting in some shortness of breath. Bhagavatam explains that there's five different kinds of prana, five even different distinct types of air that are circulating in the body that have direct influence on consciousness. And in all, practically all major religious traditions and culture, there's also a significant emphasis on the power of the life force in terms of bringing it into the world and its departure. But there's even a name for that life force. Different name, but meaning the same thing. We wrote about this in one of our, I think, sacred teachings books. And most of you know, because some of you are involved in martial arts and things also. Like in China, this life force or prana that we say in Vedic culture as prana is called qi. We know that people being able to master qi can kill you, or they can heal you, or they can, you know, they can knock you over. I mean, it's just so powerful. In Japan, it's called ki or kai. In Islamic tradition, at least in Sufism, baraka. And one of the Native American Indian traditions is called wakin. One of the African traditions, French West African Congo, is called megbi. In the Kabbalah, the Jewish tradition is called Yeshad. I'm pronouncing it right. And it goes on and on. So, same energy, same life force, but is called differently, called something according to that tradition, but the same thing is being discussed. So I want to read briefly. It's a rather short meditation. Life is simply so many breaths. Think of all the things we do in the years that we live, our education, all the job, the money that we pursue, all the things we do for our house, all the things we do for our children, for our husband, for our wife, our partners. You go on and on and on. Everything we do socially, politically, culturally, it all started with breath, and it's going to end sometime when you take the last breath. It says you held your breath, so if you do no longer have use of breath, you die. Sometimes when someone is unconscious, and we do CPR, huh? So we try to revitalize that person by taking some of our breath to stimulate their breath. And if we're successful, we get the person to breathing again, you know, on his or own. Or someone loses breath in a hospital, where medics come and they give the person oxygen. The idea is to get that person breathing on their own, so that, you know, breath goes on again. But when the breath stops, then we know, oh, okay, now this person is gone. Because at some point when there's no more breath, then it means you take the last breath and the soul the air takes the soul away. I was reading many years ago how it's been calculated the difference of weight, very, very subtle, when the soul is in the body, when the soul goes. And people who see death, maybe some of you have seen somebody die right in front of you, and you see them gasp as they take their last breath. Sometimes you can feel the presence of the soul leave the body. And according to the quality of the adhikara of the individual, determines how the soul leaves. Whether it leaves through the anus, or through the mouth, or through the top of the hair, top of the head. So according to the level of piety, determines also how the soul goes. We're reading a wonderful book on the biography of Goga Vindamaraj, and it's discussing about a particular one of his relatives, I guess his great grandfather, who was an amazing Vaishnava. He's in a family of very advanced sadhus, and his father was one of those yogis, spiritualists, great grandfather that is, who had the power and the shakti of control of prana within his own body, that he could decide, you know, when he was going to die. And this has been the case historically that some yogis have had such power of control of life and death that they say at a certain time they're going to die, and they're having discourse, or they're in the house, or they're around well-wishers, and then they just go. The last breath and the soul goes. So he had that kind of power, that influence and that control, and was so aware that he was more than the body. And of course, he had such higher consciousness. So he informed the well-wishers and relatives, and they were all together in the house. They're doing bhajan. And then he told them, okay, I'm going to go. He told them the day was going to go, the approximate time. And they were all doing the bhajan, accepting that he was going to leave, honoring his decision, and recognizing, of course, his unusual power. And then, just like you said, he was there. Bhajan was going on. And took his last breath, and he left. So, like in the case of Dhruva, where one's consciousness can be so advanced that they have not only control of the physical body or the vegas, controlling such the pushes that are normally there, enslaving others, but the consciousness is so sharp and pinpointed, they can even decide and determine by the blessings of the Lord when to leave, etc. And there are some rare entities who are aware when they came into this universe, and while they're here, they're in tune with what is going on in the higher realms. When they leave, they return to such kingdoms, such environments. The Nitya Siddhas, they're aware, and they purposely tune themselves down while they're here in the material world. They take on human-like attributes so they can preach and help and relate. But at some certain points, especially when the times when they go to Nirjan Bhajan, when they're about the point of leaving the body, then sometimes they go into a samadhi where they're physically here, but they're no longer relating to the orthodox patterns of the material world. You see in Prabhupada's last days or last weeks, how when people would come in or say different things, we saw sometimes different level of response than we would normally see. Somebody would say something about a cow, and Prabhupada would go into tears, connecting with the Surabhi cow. I mean, just little things that would be there would just immediately stimulate or refresh him with his identity in the spiritual kingdom. And the Bhagavatam, it explains how when who was it? Madhavendra Puri, I think again, saw the black rain cloud, and he went into trance, just thinking that Krishna is Ganesham, black is like black cloud, like black rain cloud, and just by seeing that, he just went into trance. So we see that sometimes paraphernalia, like in the case of the four Kumaras, just smelling the incense but was offered to the Lord, something in connection can stimulate consciousness in such ways. Well, the pure souls, they tune themselves down so they're less responding in such a way. And we saw Prabhupada made extra effort not to show his ecstasies. But there were times when it was overwhelming and it was obvious. Like the time in Atlanta, he was talking about the deities of Gaudiya time, and then he went into trance. One or two of the leaders once told me how when I would write these letters to Prabhupada, he would read them after taking lunch. The secretaries would bring them in. The letters I would write about our preaching in the communist countries. And so one letter I have, and one report, is that the Tamal Krishna Maharaj came in and brought my letter, told him that Ganesham was my earlier name. His report said, arrived. I was immediately bringing it. These are last days, last weeks, last months, actually. And so, one of the devotees told me how, as I was describing certain things, distributing the books, and on difficult situations, how Prabhupada went into a trance. Prabhupada said, and he does not know the language. He is dark color, different race in these countries. He is going on, I think, without food, water, food sometimes, whatever. And the books are getting out. Of course, in those days, you know, the communist bloc was communist bloc. We were taking risk of being in prison or risking our lives. And so, Baba was saying, and the books are going, gone. And he went into trance like that. So there were times Baba was saying, Jai Radha Manava, etc. But his concern was not to show ecstasies or to show his level of unfoldment, but to share so everyone could come to the level of being able to experience the higher realms of spirituality. And as Vaishnavas, we even go out of our way to not to show, because the idea is that so many people who do not have, and even pseudo Vaishnavas, who are not on that platform, may be more prone to pretend if physical show of purity is considered to be the standard. We know from the Nectar of Devotion, from Rupa Goswami's writings and some of the Goswami's writings, that there's certain symptoms that one may undergo as they're experiencing Bhav and what to say prema. So the hair standing up, voice choking up, rolling on the ground, losing consciousness, and even death. These are just some small symptoms of ecstasy. And so there are times when people want to seem that they're overtaken and possess such divine endowment, and they just roll on the floor or go through like an epileptic fit, suggesting that they're experiencing ecstasy. And sometimes it's just show. The acharyas and the sadhus, high-level sadhus, they would, of course, evaluate a person and could judge whether someone was just pretending or whether they were in higher state. I haven't finished the whole book yet, but I know from this biography of Govinda Maharaj, some of the devotees who used to be around him, Bhagavad Prabhu, one of my godbrothers, would mention sometimes how there were times when they saw Govinda Maharaj just completely unconscious or completely in a trance state. And the times when they took him to the hospital and they thought he was ill, but he wasn't ill, he was in trance. Life is simply so many breaths. So something happens to the breath as one leaves the body, as one engages in deep chanting and meditating, as one goes into different altered states, advanced altered states, then the breath is affected in such ways also. What we call life is really the activities performed by different species as they struggle to avoid their inevitable death. Now we also know that literally thousands of species have become extinct. So life was there for them, but now not only is life gone, but the whole species now has disappeared. Usually we think of extinction, we think of what? Very obvious, you know, dinosaurs. We don't see dinosaurs, you know, walking down the streets. And we rarely, you know, see them, some replica of them, right, you know, in museums. But just think how such creatures were very, very, you know, very numerous. And we don't see one of them. So not only does life leave for a particular entity or a particular species, but sometimes the entire species is no longer there. What we call life is different species as they struggle to avoid the inevitable death. So different cultures, different communities have their different ways of how they're struggling, and how they struggle determines what is considered to be life. Somebody who is very poor, their struggles, life is harder for them. Eating, sleeping, bathing, defending. Somebody is considered to be quite endowed with wealth, at least eating, sleeping, bathing, defending for them is not such an issue. They try to avoid or cheat all devouring death by focusing on eating, sleeping, bathing, defending. As if they can keep on doing these things, then you know, life is going to go on. It is true that for the survival of each species, all of these areas are important to fulfill and to maintain. However, they still do not check death from attacking and defeating the members of each species. When someone has few or no obstructions in their eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, it is considered by social standards that they're having a good life. As we measure time, we think of how long or how much longer an entity has in its present body. We reflect on events and activities associated with an entity or entire species. In 24 hours, some species are born, reproduce, and die, while other species live for hundreds of years. And some species, just in 24 hours, they take their first breath, they literally reproduce, they deteriorate, and they die. And others, it can take hundreds of years before they take their last breath. However, in either case, it's all relative to the nature of the living entity. Life is simply so many breaths. When we take our last breath in this body, the soul departs and petitions for its next existence. The whole of creation simply endures during the breath of Mahavishnu. Now just think about that. As it is withdrawn and when he inhales and exhales. You just think that all of what is going on, you're esoteric, and all of the universes, and all the many, many yugas, except that life is going on, different interactions and arrangements and relations, that all of that is just Mahavishnu inhaling and exhaling, and inhaling and it's all over. Exhaling is all there. Just like we just took a little breath in and out. We held our breaths. So if we exhale and we create universes and universes of millions and billions of people and things going on. And we inhale and wipe them all out. The power and the arrangement of the power of breath. So we are all maintained and supported by Mahavishnu's inhaling and exhaling. This is, of course, an aspect of God, of Krishna, that is creating and annihilating the universe, or eliminating the universe. In the spiritual world, there is no deterioration of the body, no death, and no time. Everything is always existent and always exists. Yes, events and activities are variegated, ever fresh, full of joy, and eternal. The material world is called Kunta, a place of misery and anxiety. While the spiritual world is conversely called what? Vaikuntha, which is a place of no suffering and, of course, no anxiety. Bhaya, or fear, pervades all atmospheres in the material universe. So there are such things as what's called shoka, or lamentation, lamenting. Which leads us to try to speed up, slow down, or stop various events from happening. For some, kala, or time, is their best friend. Because in time, something wonderful or pleasant will happen for others, or for oneself. Well, I mean, what's an example for somebody who may see time as their best friend? Something wonderful is going to happen in the future. I mean, what's off the top of your head? What's an example?
Raise.
Huh?
Raise. Or promotion.
Promotion, yeah. In 6 months, I'm going to get a promotion. And so they're looking, and time is going to be their best friend. Because in 6 months, they're going to get a bonus, or promotion. They're going to get extra $20,000, $10,000 bonus. You like that new job, right? Mm-hmm. And you get a raise. You know, double your salary. They don't double salaries these days, do they? You're lucky if you got a job that gives you a $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 bonus. You get something that So you know that's going to come. You're excited. What's another example? The time is something one is anticipating with great enthusiasm.
Retirement.
Retirement. Retire. And then after people retire, then they get sad. They go, what am I going to do myself? I was looking at, I was reflecting on some statistics in business, especially with men. So many high-level CEOs, especially the men, because women have more of a social support system, that high-level CEOs, after they retire, that many of them, their lifespan is only five to seven mm-hmm. years.
Wow.
Because they lose a sense of identity. Or they realize that all they thought was happening so wonderfully that it's not quite what they thought. Or they're watching the organization, the business change, different from what they can control, whatever. But somehow they... But more than likely it means that they've identified so much with their identity as being the controller of that. When they don't have that, they lose identity, they lose sometimes the desire to live. And so they, you know, for long they take their last breath. The fear is associated with the constant uncertainty about the future. Now the other thing is also, for some people, the fear of time just puts them in anxiety. Because what's expected is inauspicious. I mean, like I'm dealing with now, it looks like my cancer is trying to accelerate again. So in some ways, time is wonderful because I have time to try to be more mindful and do what I can while I can. But in another sense, if it keeps on like this, in time, I take my last breath. For some, color or time is their best friend. I don't look at it, though, do I?
Yeah.
In terms of my prosthesis, my walking, so I'm on a cane now and not two crutches and gradually learning how to walk and get a little more weight, but something else is going. I think the diabetes is going, well, that's a little out of whack. Some things are in place and other things are out. For some, color or time is their best friend because in time, something wonderful, pleasant will happen. For others, time is their worst enemy, for in the future they will experience some great misfortune. However, for all species or entities that do not become Krishna, or of course God conscious, time will prove to be an ultimate enemy in disguise. It means for anyone who doesn't pursue a God-conscious lifestyle, ultimately, time will be a big enemy for them. Because in time, they're going to have to give reciprocation for all of the sinful things that they've done. Their karma is going to come on them. For those who do not pursue self-realization, they will be chastised and thrown into other material bodies to experience once again birth, death, old age, and disease. For those who become self-realized, they can return to the spiritual world in the kingdom of God, where there is no deterioration of body, no death, and no time. Everything is always easy. It's hard to imagine an environment where everything always was, always has existed, and always will. Excuse me, an environment where there's no death, there's no deterioration, and our whole conception of life and relationship and association is different. Different shades of experiences. Everything has always existed and always will exist in the spiritual world. Yes, events and activities are variegated, ever fresh, full of joy, and eternal. For some unfortunate souls who in the future must experience some specific chastisement, penalty, or difficulty, reflecting on the future brings us greater and greater anxieties and fears. An example is like the story, the other beggar we read how chronic disease is like a, you know, it's like a death sentence, or like an inmate being sentenced to die, prisoner. An example is the inmate on death row who has been sentenced to death in 1 month, or the hostage who receives the news that he or she will be assassinated in 24 hours. Even the worker who finds out that he or she must start working with a team of colleagues in 1 week who will give him or her hell will experience tremendous anxiety. Sometimes you have different project and you think, oh my God, I got to work with these guys again. Got to work with this group of people. You just an anxiety as it comes closer and closer to when you all have to team up together. And of course, if it's a good association, you're thinking in terms of time as anticipating the wonderful experience that's going to come soon. Others who anticipate a great boon, reward, or auspicious accomplishment are very excited as they contemplate and anticipate the future. For example, the prisoner who learns that he or she will be paroled in 1 month, the hostage who finds out that he can return to his family in 24 hours, and the worker who is informed that he'll be promoted to the position of a CEO in 1 week. Imagine how happy somebody is. And hearing that in 1 week's time, you are going to be in charge of this organization. The person's already thinking how they're going to get on other people's case. Yes, I'll be in charge. They take out their grudges. You start thinking, okay, I'll be in the big office. Put up a sign, a nice sign, bigger than that one that's up there. Change my cards now. I don't mind spending the money now to change my letterhead, my card. So I do joyfully. And if I can see you, I have to get a new car. Yeah? Can't be the CEO in this car. New suits. And unfortunately, you may think, I got to get a new wife now. Just imagine how much excitement and happiness the residents of the spiritual world are constantly, as they are constantly having this knowing that every future experience will be an encounter, will be more rewarding and fulfilling than previous encounters. The more rewarding the future events will be, the greater the anticipation, excitement, and joy. As we have stated, in the spiritual world, there is no deterioration of body, no death, and no time. Everything has always existed and will always exist. Yes, events and activities are variegated, ever fresh, full of joy, and eternal. In the material world, as time is ticking away, some people are very excited about some temporary boon, reward, or achievement, while others are in great anxiety about a future chastisement, punishment, or penalty. All will ultimately experience kala, time that is, as most cruel if the real purpose of life, liberation, is not realized, because the ultimate results and rewards will be another material body and one of the material universes that are mainly designated or designed to facilitate the living entities and species in their endeavor to run away from the eternal home, the kingdom of God. Then I conclude this meditation by mentioning about Prahlad Maharaj. Prahlad Maharaj emphasizes that we must not waste this life and its valuable time. Remember how Prahlad Maharaj, even though he was so young, he was a kid, he was emphasizing that one should not procrastinate, one should not wait, one should immediately involve themselves in pursuance of God consciousness. So even as a child, we must ultimately pursue a more meaningful life. Katvanga Maharaj became fully God conscious in just moments. So one doesn't always, you know, we see sometimes it takes lifetimes, or it can take moments, like in this case. We do not have to procrastinate or involve ourselves in superfluous activities. For the materialist who will encounter temporary as well as ultimate punishments, temporary and ultimate anxiety will be their rewards. And that's for the Vishayis. Since Gatavik fires. But the rewards will be different for the devotees of the Lord who contemplate on a future in which they can return to the spiritual world. A place in which there is no deterioration of body, no death, no time, where everything has always existed and always will exist. Yes, events and activities are variegated, ever fresh, full of joy, and eternal. All species and entities should use this life for what it really meant, what it's really meant for, rather than just for eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Not just wasting so many breaths and encountering varieties of temporary happiness and distress. This chapala sukha, happiness there, but comes and goes quickly. We should use life as a divine opportunity to become deathless in a timeless existence where we can eternally participate and breathe in the nectar of Krishna Katha, the Bhakti Ras. I am that lowly beggar who will soon give up his material, who will soon give up his last material breath to humbly breathe in the nectar of Krishna's aroma. So, what we discuss in this little reflection is we're looking at Pranache, that where Bhakti Siddhanta is saying one must have life to preach. So I do, so do, per day, and as we are preaching and sharing, we feel more enlivened, we have more to give, and hopefully with more potency as we become more realized. That in all the different traditions and religions and cultures also, there's some emphasis to the significance of breath. We get an example of the case of Dhruva Maharaj, how by controlling the prana within himself, he was able to influence the prana within in the whole of creation. So we all have that potentiality or that potency of having more control of what's going on within our own consciousness that can affect the entire universe or the world around us, whether it's say our institutions, our communities, and our families. We mentioned how those who are paranjans or vishayis, how they're eager just fulfilling the demands of the senses, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, and how the body itself is tridhatu, just really comprised of mucus and bowel and air. Our meditation was dealing mostly with the air aspect or breath. We are born, breath is there, and we leave, we take the last breath, and the soul is carried on by the breath. And then we looked at different things in relationship to kala or time, and how for some time is very wonderful, because in time many wonderful things will come upon them based on good karma, what has been said and done and what has been put into motion will bring all kinds of auspiciousness. We gave examples, some material examples of anticipation with enthusiasm and joy. Then we have other cases where because of some inauspiciousness around the corner that there's going to be chastisement, punishment, or there's going to be suffering. Vishwanath Chakravarti talks about this in terms of the kleshas or different types of miseries and distresses. We have the papa or the sin, and that's manifested in parabdha and purabdha, that there's some inauspicious things and that's come upon us already. We've already experienced the duality and the suffering, you know, from that. And there are certain things that are around the corner that in the future we will have to experience. And so in some cases we know of it, we're cognizant, in other cases we're not. In some cases we're aware that we made some offense and now we're going to have to pay for it. Or something we've done, and pretty soon we're going to reap the results. In other cases, we realize that because we've done the right thing, or we've been recognized as a high achiever in some way, that we are excited about what we're going to benefit from that. So the conclusion of this is that as we take our last breath, or look forward to taking the last breath, it should be with anticipation and excitement. Because kala should mean for us, the future should mean for us, that we'll be able to receive the benefits of quality devotion that we have been engaged in this lifetime. And so we don't have to fear about being snatched by Yamaraj and his attendants, but do we have to fear about having to take another material body? But our excitement and joy should be that as time goes on and as we come to the ultimate time arrangement where we leave the body, that we'll be able to go back to the kingdom of God in the spiritual world where we're saying where there's no death, no deterioration, everything's eternal and full of joy, the asraya tattva, the divine abode of love. So for a Vaishnava, meditating about any aspect of the future should be exciting. as long as our past and present has been quality offerings of devotion. And where not, then we should also be in fear, because we should realize that we're going to be accountable for any deviations or any sinful things that we've been engaged in. Hare Krishna. So any questions or any comments? Anyone else? Is the microphone from the press or? Where's like a beer in Brazil? They're in the kitchen for them. Probably they can hear the class.
Hare Krishna. You said that Vaishnava should be enthusiastic about the future. Mm-hmm. But sometimes when we look at ourselves and we notice there are so many anarthas in my heart, and you feel that my spiritual life will be going to be a big, big struggle for me in the future. So in that circumstance, how can we be enthusiastic? Because we know that we have to overcome a lot of difficult things before we can become a devotee.
We can't. We can't be so enthusiastic. We can't be so enthusiastic. This utsaha, enthusiasm, will be artificial. If we're enthusiastic about all the sins that's going on in our life or all the nonsense going on in our mind, no, we can't be so. We can't be spiritually enthusiastic. We can be enthusiastic in some mundane way. But our spiritual enthusiasm will be so much based on our spiritual growth. Just like, you know, say if you're, you know, if you're married and you have a young son. So can you be enthusiastic in seeing your son just go into crime, one crime after another crime? Not if you're a good father or a concerned parent. So you'll be concerned, but you won't be enthusiastic. But if you have your same father, same son, and that son is a wonderful achiever, he's a gentleman, he's doing good in his sports, doing good in his school, he is you know, very respectful, so many different nice attributes, ethical, moral, etc., then you're enthusiastic about the present, of how he's doing, and you're enthusiastic considering that with all hopes that he'll carry all these qualities in the future and into manhood, go through different rites of passages, samskaras, and come out of it with great character. So we can't be so enthusiastic if our present is not in a line to what we would really want. And to work with that, then one has to try to change what is going on in the present so that they are not so possessed with anarthas. Just keep in mind, what we give the most time and energy to is what you're going to get more of. So if you're an alcoholic and you're taking so much alcohol, you're thinking that, well, in the future I'm going to give up alcohol. Oh, Haribo, good luck. You're smoking, and you're so absorbed in smoking, you're thinking, in the future I'm going to give up cigarettes. But the future is an extension of the present. If you haven't started giving up now, what guarantees you're going to give it up later? It's going to become harder later, you'll be more habituated to it. But if you were smoking two packs of cigarettes, and now you're smoking one, then you're smoking one a day, you can have enthusiasm that soon I won't smoke any. You can be enthusiastic and think, well, I've come from, you know, two packs to one pack. Like when I first put on this prosthesis, I was thinking, how can anybody walk in something as heavy as four legs put together? It's like 3-4 times heavier than a normal leg. I thought, this is impossible. And then I started walking on it with the two crutches. Well, I was in a wheelchair and in the two crutches, and now the last few days I'm just walking on a cane. About to fall every few minutes, but I'm learning, you know, some balance in that sense. So I can be enthusiastic and think, okay, it won't be too long that I'll be jumping up and down again. I'll be outrageous. Then you're all jumping up in the kirtan. So I can feel enthusiastic by the increment of steps that have taken place. So we see certain temporary victories, we can be enthusiastic about a long-term victory.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so, there's a arena of thought that you're laying out the community. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, could you expand on about someone who, help me, changing their inner self can change the cosmos? Know,
yes.
You said something like
sure.
That.
Exactly.
And then beyond that, if one person can do that, then what happens if you got multiple people doing that? And how do they interact?
That's right.
Influencing the cosmos.
That's a very good question. Mm-hmm. It's already happening now. I mean, you think how what we normally consider to be a healthy life is so much based on the fads, so much based on the tradition, so much based on culture, and so much based on what famous people do. Mm-hmm. The power that entertainers, you know, musicians, actors, and sportsmen have, especially now in today's society, it's just overwhelming. I mean, some entertainers start dressing a certain way, and you have literally hundreds of millions of people who start dressing, you know, in that way. You have a very famous actor who starts, you know, driving a certain kind of car. And you have now, you know, millions of people trying to get that car. I mean, I can't believe now this expensive car people are driving now. I think it's like a tank.
Hummer.
I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, many years ago, people wouldn't think that that kind of car would be considered to be prestigious. Think something small and you know, unique looking, something that's big and gross, looks like it's like a bulldozer, and you know, but because it's of course, you know, built strong, but also because some famous people have spent their money for it, and now it's prestigious. When you see that car come down the street, you look in almost to see who's driving it, you know. And you sit in somebody's yard, you think they're doing well. You know, the other day, one of the aspiring disciples from Cleveland, it was a couple of months ago, you know, he came in and getting out of one of those things. And I was thinking, first time we had one of these cars. First I was wondering, whose car is this? And I thought, oh, okay. He's, you know, the financing, he's doing good. And down the street, somebody has one. I was thinking, what are they doing? So, but the point, going to make the point, though, is that already we see how, especially people who were watched a lot, thought about a lot, how their energy affects so many others. Mm-hmm. But we all have that power. Mm-hmm. That within each of us, as we control our own lives and consciousness, we have so much ability to affect millions of people. And you've seen from revolutionists, from the civil rights leaders, from the spiritualists, even from politicians, what is it, entertainers, how there are times when a person is so fixed in what he or she are doing, so focused on a certain vision, that means they have so much within themselves, their own constitution, and it's that that then influences others to accept their vision. So we all know this, but sometimes we minimize how it happens and how much each of us have the ability to create the kind of community and even the kind of world. Mm-hmm. Now, because unfortunately, so many people are misusing their energies for promiscuousness, or they're being controlled by the propaganda and by the fads. So they're putting into the atmosphere all of these mantras, all of these songs that are degrading. Dress styles that are sensuous and doing things that do not reinforce community or are not healthy for the ecology, not healthy for their own bodies, the way they eat, the way they're made, defend, all of these things. Now, because you have so much of that aggregating, then we have what we have to deal with now. We have just ways and ways of difficulty that we have to move through. Mm-hmm. So when you try to educate someone and you try to work on yourself, even, you're having to work on yourself while you're being bombarded by a general current of negativity. Now, because of that, it's so important for healthy sangha or healthy gatherings of like-minded people, because then, as each individual is working on his own sadhana or spiritual struggle journey toward sati, toward the goal, then they are helped and supported by the energy and consciousness that's involved with those who they associate with, who have some similar aspirations, like these little gatherings we have now, or we have at other places. They are seemingly small but important, in that it helps each person when he or she goes back now to work or home or does whatever they have to do for the whole week, mm-hmm. that it gives them some stimulation, and it's like charging the individual up, mm-hmm. because from that they've gotten spiritual and conscious nourishment. Mm-hmm. And many times we find that, especially with leaders who start off with really good intentions, then we start seeing them sell the people out, or we start seeing them deviate. Well, a lot of times it happens that previously they were reinforcing themselves, building themselves, and protecting themselves, and being more concerned about their own controlling the energies within them. And then later they get so busy doing things, or they have so much success, they start minimizing self fulfillment, mm-hmm. nourishment, I mean, not fulfillment, but because that can mean many things. They start minimizing, you know, self nourishment. They start minimizing self protection, reinforcing and charging themselves. Or they don't have a protocol in their lives that allows them to get rejuvenated. Mm-hmm. And then you start seeing them, you know, deteriorate. Mm-hmm. And they change, even though previously they had a certain fortitude. Mm-hmm. So, especially with leadership, one has to be even more careful, because you are involved with people often who may have lower energy, mm-hmm. or you're trying to raise, or you're going into environments trying to act as a steward. But while going through those environments, you have to realize that you're being bombarded mm-hmm. by the other negative patterns. Mm-hmm. And so to help, you have to be like a, you know, a good nurse or a doctor. You can't do that and deal with disease if you're diseased yourself. Mm-hmm. So you know disease is there, so you have to protect yourself. So while trying to help the patient, you don't become inflicted with the disease. Mm. Other questions?
Yes. Guruji, thank you. Is this on?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for helping me through the breath situation mm-hmm. about 5 years ago when my mother passed. And yet she was holding on to me, but as the breath went away, I didn't become all, you know, I've been out of shape, so to speak. But my brother was downstairs making all the rain with the material stuff. Mm-hmm. And since then, they've steadily gone down, and I have come up in the community as getting another grant. And so I want to help, ask the Institute to help with certain prashadam with the funds I'll be getting in the community.
Okay, so you
leave no child behind.
Okay.
Is giving out this award. And the second thing.
Is it focused more on children?
On the parents.
The grant on the parents?
Trying to help the parents. Mm-hmm. They found out that that's where the problem is.
And then for the parents to then be able to help the children.
To help the children. Because they're coming through with a test now. And if they don't pass that test, mm-hmm. out of there, they really want to do something with a disruption. Mm-hmm. So hopefully tomorrow I will be open at a site where mm-hmm. the Institute can help me with the shot and receive the The second thing I want to ask you about, what are your take about Michael? Do you think he's near suicide now, that all of this material...
Michael Jackson.
All this material support that he's gotten has now disappeared, and he didn't hold on to any spirituality.
Has he been tried yet? I'm out of the loop with, you know, the news these days.
Well, he's in trial now.
It keeps coming back. It keeps saying
Well, time will show what the, you know, the judicial system will, how it prevailed in his case. But what we do see, a theme there, is that you can have so much wealth and so much fame, and it can go overnight, or you can become infamous, you know, overnight. I mean, look how, you know, President Nixon, who's a previous president, was president of the most so-called powerful country in the world, America, at a time when America was like really out there, its influence and domination. And after he left the office, he became, you know, extremely depressed and died a very, you know, very kind of a sad life. So you can, and there are many, many cases of that, where someone has tremendous influence or tremendous wealth, tremendous fame, and a few or even one mistake, and to the degree that they were famous, you know, they become infamous, become known, you know, for that mistake. Because they're more in the public, more in the light, etc. When we are having so many people honor us, worship us, depend on us, it's a huge calling. And it can do very unusual things, you know, to people. I mean, many of you know, you either lecture or you, maybe in the past you were entertainers or you have done things where you're in front of a big audience. It's like a drug. And especially when you got so many eyes and people who are just, you know, at your mercy, kind of speak, so to speak. So it's very difficult, and we have to have our hearts go out for those kind of people who become so famous like that and not understand all the other aspects that's involved with that. That they're karmically responsible for so many things. If they are singing his mantras that's, you know, full of degradation, the degree that they inspire people for social degradation, mm-hmm. they're karmically held for that. Mm-hmm. The degree that they are able to help motivate others, they, you know, that they benefit. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes, because of the strain and the stress from those kind of jobs, without some spiritual fulfillment and some healthy support system, it's almost inevitable. The person is going to take more support from drugs. You know, just to pump themselves up so they can go on, make themselves available for others to be happy. I mean, it's, you know, and it's a rough schedule, you know. You've been on a circuit of moving around, lecturing or entertaining or, you know, being in a band or something. And every place you go, you know, you have to perform your best. Doesn't matter how good you, say you're in a play, doesn't matter how good your play was last week, now you're in another location and you have to give your best. So it's, you know, very little downtime in that way. And it burns people out. That's why most of the people in those entertainment industries, you know, their lives are a total wreck. So Michael Jackson's case is kind of typical of what can happen. A life that's full of variegatedness, full of seemingly certain incoherences, fame, and also a lot of attention based on that thing. And also shows that everybody is needy. Everybody's looking for innocence and affection and love. And we can find it in perverted ways. We can find it in healthy ways. I mean, history will, you know, will reveal what, you know, what really happens and what the situation is. But I mean, more than likely, here's someone who has to be out there all the time and to be very on the mark, but who really has a rather innocent nature, and is actually rather pious. And so, because of that, and because of not having a strong enough spiritual support system or whatever, then he may have found himself finding an interest in innocence with, you know, young boys, you know, and some, you know, just perverted, of course, and it's very unfortunate. But it probably had to do with being so much into a life of having to be out there and a life of a lot of bureaucracy and whatnot, and then just you know, kind of retreating to a childlike environment where he's got his own little, you know, fairyland world and all that it comes along, you know, comes along with that. But you know, his case will come out more and more in the coming days. Any other questions?
Could you share with us some of your visions for the long-term or short-term projects for the Institute for Applied Spiritual Technology?
I would like to ask you guys to share yours. That's all up to yourself, what you're concerned with. We started the Institute for two or three basic reasons. Akinder mentions it, Madhava mentions it in the Spiritual Way 1, the questions and answers. We were, you know, I had spent most of my time first in America for a while as a brahmachari, and then in most of the communist countries, and then in Africa for 10, 12 years. So at one point, you know, we had all these temples we had built in Africa, farms. We even started some boutiques and clinics and stuff. And like now we got this, you know, some places where we have free clinics. We are stuck now trying to send a lot of equipment to Ghana to open up another free clinic. So we got to the point that, you know, things are happening, you know. We had 10 temples alone, you know, just in Nigeria. Well, 12. Mm, 5 or 6 in Ghana. Ivory Coast, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Monrovia, land, temples, project, you know, on and on. So, after, I think it was after our visit to President Kaunda, who was then president of Zambia and was president of the OAU. So we were meeting presidents, you know, we're meeting presidents and giving them books and talking to them and doing some typical things. So I think it was after that meeting we were thinking that, but what have we done in America? And I would come back to America for a visit and I'd go. I didn't have any GBC obligations because my field was, my hands-on work was Africa at that point. But I'm born in America, I have some obligation, obviously. But especially I was thinking that I would like to find more ways to reach people, look at people who are not coming to Krishna consciousness. And I was thinking, in America, we don't have so many professional people on a massive scale coming. And I also noticed that we don't have so many minorities. So I was trying to think, well, Washington is a place where, I don't know, what is it, 85% African-American? What's the percentage of blacks here in Washington? 80%, 85%? 75, 80%. So I thought Washington would be a good place. And I already had, we had a restaurant here and a boutique and a few things that was going on. So my concern was how to do more outreach, where people wouldn't have to immediately go to the temple and be overwhelmed. Because people are very ethnic conscious, especially Americans. Americans are very puffed up. So the tendency is to go to the temple, they see mostly Indians and they think, well, this is just a Hindu organization. Or if there are other minorities, they think, oh, this is just for Europeans or whatever. So I thought, okay, how can I try to create some situation that will first try to reach maybe professional people, and then how can I use my own body to try to reach, you know, people of ethnic background, ethnicity, of color. So I started then kind of pushing myself more in terms of my African connection as an African high chief. And I started dressing in my, you know, African regalia sometimes, etc. But the main thing I was doing was trying to go out in the community and to present topics that, didn't matter who it was, that if they were saying, they should have an interest. And then just try to use that topic to give a transcendental perspective. You know, whatever it may be. Parenting, male-female relationships, health, it didn't matter, whatever it was. You know, abortion, sex life, I mean, anything. I just used the topic and we would announce it. I think we're having the meetings every Thursday or something, or once a week. And to draw people in the community to come to here. So we started off very small scale because we didn't have anything. It was just Yasoda, Kendra, Raja Leela, and let's see, Mahamantra, I think came later. And we were living in the basement, somebody's house, not far from Walter Reed Hospital. It had one window. You hold up, you know, like a basement window. And we did everything. It was, you know, it was like, that was our temple, that was our kitchen, that was our, you know, our living quarters. Women just had a little sheet for their area. We were in the other area. You know, we all slept on the floor. And, you know, we even come into the, you know, you could only come in from the back, you know, you go down like a cellar. This is how the Institute started. But we started with the idea that I was thinking, how do you start a movement or a enterprise, spiritual enterprise, an organization, without money, without facility, without, you know, man or woman power. So the idea was, you have a topic that'll draw people, use somebody else's place, use a place that people can frequent easy, and you just start building it up. So Chintamani, I think, later came from some of the culture events we were having. She was then going to Howard. She's finishing up her PhD degree. So I think she was the one. My memory's bad, but if I recall, maybe Rod Lito write all this up in Malati in the biography. So she arranged for us to use a room at Howard. So now here we had a room in a place that people could come to easily, and with facility, we didn't have to pay. So here we had, and although we didn't have any facility ourselves, and we were even, you know, totally embarrassed to bring anybody to where we lived. Mm-hmm. And there was no question. We would tell somebody that, you know, this is a nice philosophy, a nice organization, movement, and we're, you know, nice spiritual people. Mm-hmm. And all we have is a little basement where, you know, four or five of us are living in such a way. Even the air quality was bad. Yeah. So, as that started, and a handful of people would come. First, we just had a little room. And the next thing, we got, you know, an auditorium. Now, all while we were doing this, now here I was unknown, right? And even now, for instance, now, there's no reason why by now we shouldn't do an Oprah Winfrey show, do national TV here. I do it every other place in the world. The national TV, the top news programs, top radio shows, top talk shows, practically every country in the world I go to, except America. And I'm American. But it's hard because where do I fit in? I'm like an African, Hindu, cultish Swami, what some people would think. I mean, I got all these books out, I'm talking all these topics, and I don't fit into a normal pattern. Now, if I was a revolutionist, a cultural nationalist, if I was just a Christian minister or whatever, then what I'm doing, it'd be easy to get, you know, more air, but I don't fit into people's patterns, so it's a little difficult in that sense. So here I had to start off in this, an environment where not only did I have any GBC responsibilities, did not have any disciples, did not have any money, did not have any, and you see, I wasn't known, and I was given a philosophy that most people would consider to be just too unusual, or would I even want to come that close. Many pious people, if they knew what the philosophy was, they would accept it. That's what they could hear it. So the idea was use facility that belongs to use other people's facilities, and use arrangements that can amplify the message outside of what was in one's own resources. You know, so you try to campaign something, you try to, you know, do propaganda. So my idea was, okay, radio, since I do TV and radio, can't do so much TV here, but let me do radio. So then I started doing a lot of radio shows. And then we would time some of them, so we would do a radio show a day or two before the meeting that we would have once a week. And it got to a point, I remember one time, we did two radio shows, maybe three in one week. And one radio show the day before, maybe that morning before, we invited people to come down, that I'd be personally speaking and available, answer questions or whatever, that evening at Howard. And that evening we had we had a room that was normally, I think, about 200 people. And that evening we had a group of like 500 people. We just came from all over the place, and we had to shift into, you know, another facility. Then later we got an auditorium, so we could accommodate as many people as, you know, as we could. But it started off like that with no facility, no money, no notoriety, etc. But just an idea in this way, and how to get around the things that would cause people not to want to understand Krishna consciousness. So I thought, some people don't want to approach it because of the way we dress. Some people because the fact that they won't take the time to come to the Tua temple. Many people that come all the way out to Potomac, because it's very difficult, even for those who know the place, to come. Unless you have a car and you know, it's a little difficult. And so these different things. So I started looking at the reasons why people wouldn't say yes and how to get around them. So then from that, we started meeting once a week. And every week we would have a different topic. And this is the first book that came out, Spiritual Warrior 1. It was all the lectures that came from that series. And Spiritual Warrior 2. A new edition, now we've got Spiritual Warrior 2. All of those are lectures that we were doing once a week that later were put together into a book. Now, from those lectures, we made, maybe 50 or so, 60, devotees. People who became directly involved in, they later took initiation. And, of course, many of you, many of Institute devotees is how they came. And practically all the devotees were professionals. They were, involved in their professions. And we once asked, even in the case of Ekavir, when he was an accountant, remember once I think of Gita Nag, we asked, and once here, how many would have come into Krishna consciousness if they knew initially that, I was a Hare Krishna devotee? And that this is what they were, being given. And 98% of the devotees said no, that they wouldn't have joined. And now those same devotees are maintaining deities and doing, and the temple presidents in Detroit, and devotees were maintaining Gita Nagari, and some of you are here, and some in other parts of the world now, from the institute activities. So it gave me an arena to experiment some. And I'm an independent person, so that was sort of natural in that sense. And it allowed me to make a major attempt in trying to particularly reach out to the African-American community, who had very little interest in Krishna consciousness. It just seemed too foreign. There was very little reason for them to consider joining, or even to investigate it. And by also having the African connection and being a political activist and social reformer, and speaking on topics that were relevant, it helped many people to see this is kind of the next step for them. Because most people I attracted were African Americans who were already studying yoga, who were involved in metaphysical teachings. Some of them had been initiated in different groups, Muktananda, Sri Chamoy. Practically all of them had been involved in either some kind of holistic activities. And almost all of them had been involved previously, in this revolutionary politics. So I attracted African Americans who I felt were pious and were literally stuck and didn't know it. And I felt Prabhupada Krishna allowed me to reach out and to give them the next higher thing. There were African Americans who've been hearing again and again, the cultural rap, to the point that it had become like, okay, one lecture is another lecture. They go on, they hear about Afrocentricity and hear this, that. And then they begin to realize, hey, it's about theocentricity. It goes beyond just the body platform. Body identity helped them to kind of straighten up from the drugs in some cases, or promiscuous activity, to work on their health, their diet, all of these things. And so it was a prime target. People who had undergone some austerities. Not to mention a few, but just like Ananda Rupa and Ranti Dev and people like that. I mean, they had been engaged in, yoga and meditation groups and initiated by different gurus quite some time, like Madhava, who we hear. He had been in Buddhism, for years and years. I mean, all of them had been involved in practically some kind of, connection, in that sense, some alternative thing. And I think it was no accident that the way we approach, and that's why it was kind of easy, because it's like some of them, like Jamabadi and a few others, they didn't even have to meet me personally. They just saw me on TV. And like in the case of Jamabadi, she saw me on TV and she realized she had been seeing me in dreams. And I have many disciples, not many, but some disciples around the world. She hear my voice, or they see me. And we had that with Prabhupada. because connection from a previous life. And so Kathy Hughes helped a lot. Her radio shows and her TV. And some of them came through TV. Kabir heard me on radio. And the voice, you know, just captured him. It's like Prabhupada's voice just captured me before I physically met him, and I heard his voice. So in one sense, we can say that they were already my disciples, and they were waiting for the message to appear so they could come forth in that way. So now the nature of the Institute, what was it doing? So it was doing health things. It was focused on hatha yoga and alternative health concerns. It was focused on trying to have programs at different people's homes. And the idea is those who have their professions, how to use their professions in Krishna consciousness. But the biggest issue was how to keep the balance between maintaining your financial material concerns and to still find ways to go on with your spiritual life. That's been the biggest struggle for most Institute devotees. Is that practically everybody's full-time job. And how to do that, and at the same time, to keep your priority in Krishna consciousness. You know, other devotees came, like Garuda and Arjuna. You know, they came to the martial arts aspect. So at one point we had a dojo, we had a martial arts institute in Tacoma Park. And the Sringa Dave, you know, there. And so it was arranged so there would be, I think, 2 days of the physical martial arts and 1 or 2 days, you know, the philosophy. And so they came in through that door. And now, I mean, I'm just taking care of the books with my major editors and gurus. You know, it's totally absorbed in deity worship and also cooking here. And so they came in that way. They didn't come through the Howard or the Afrocentric aspect. They came through the outreach. You know? And others came who were also involved in New Age groups, alternative groups, from the Institute's activities. They had friends or others who, you know, made the connection. Now, for some people, that chased them away. There were some people in white bodies, just being around so many people in black skin, it was uncomfortable. You know, and that's just how people, you know, are brought up. I remember having one really nice devotee, this is before I started the Institute, and he once came to see me, and he says, "Maharaj, I really can't work with you." He says, "I can work with you, but you know, I'm not comfortable being around so many black people." And I respected him, but he was honest. You know, it was a whole new experience for him. That the restaurant we had was served as a preaching center in Lower Capitol Hill area. And the majority of the devotees there were in black bodies. And it was just so unusual for him just to be around. I mean, hopefully he's grown out of that now. But he wasn't able to, you know, it was an issue for him. And then in some cases, as you all get a little older, some of you are not married, you start looking out for a husband or a wife. And in most cases, the best way to find a husband or wife, more guaranteed that it's going to have longevity, is a person to have as many similarities as you have. The more you're alike in so many ways, the more likely it's going to be that their partner, you know, is going to be a good partner. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless you're highly, highly spiritual, nothing else matters. Doesn't matter what ethnicity, doesn't matter your political persuasion, economic background, none of that. But there are going to be a whole lot of times when that spiritual life is going to be not quite so prominent and your ethnicity is going to kick in. And so somehow, if you prefer this or that and you like this kind of music or you have this idea about time and space or whatever, the other person is different. When you're not so Krishna conscious, all that's going to kick in. And if it's not so similar, it's going to be problems. I mean, it's like I arrange, you know, I honor lots of interracial marriages, but I also understand to the degree that people are not highly spiritual, it's going to be a problem. Mm-hmm. Because you need to have as many similarities in that relationship as possible. Now, sometimes people are more similar of different races than of the same race. But if there's not too many similarities, then that's going to kick in and it's going to cause a problem. So I've seen many people, not many, but I've seen several people who were professionals, who are in the Institute, who no longer are participating, because one, as they look around, they didn't see a real prospective husband. And I can understand that. I mean, it's an issue. It's a real issue. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be a part of something, you'll give your life to it. you also want to see that you're going to be able to have a mate that you can share that experience with. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some who came from the New Age background, some who were professionals, and who I know could have stayed if they could have had a mate that honored the same philosophy that, you know, the chemistry worked. You know. And that's why when I seem to be joking, but I'm serious as hell, when we have these big festivals and I say, this is the time for you to also find a mate. and it always works. I mean, every major festival we have, is, you know, there's at least a couple of people who then say, well, you know, we're pursuing a relationship now. You know, and, you know, this recent festival we had with all these devotees coming from over 25 different countries was beautiful in so many ways. So many ways you can say it was beautiful. But another way is that some people, you know, found someone who, you know, they're communicating with now. And let's hope it turns into something, you know, that's fulfilling. And one of the things in the Sanghas, whether it's the Bhakti Vrikshas or the Namahatas or whatever, just going to the temple, is that people should be able at some point to, you know, to find a mate, to find a partner in those environments. You don't want to find a lifetime partner, you know, in a bar, you know, in a cabaret or something, or you know, even in the movies. Well, let me go to the movies. I'm going to find my soulmate in the movies. Good luck. If you're trying to be spiritual, you want to find, you're more likely to find someone in that environment that's about the kind of things that you're trying to be about. So that was that, and we did that for a while. At one point, we had the Institute building. You know, we had a three-story building. And next to it, we also had another house. And so we would have, which was, I think, two-story. And at one point, we had fireside chats. Where we literally advertised, you know, for singles. You know, we tried all kinds of things in the early days of the Institute. And it was wonderful. So we'd literally sit around in the wintertime around the fireplace, and we have a devotee who was a facilitator, and we'd emphasize singles for spiritualists, and we'd have people who were involved in some spiritual path who were single, who wanted to meet someone else who was spiritual in their spiritual path, and they would come sit around and have prasadam and have a devotee facilitate the discussion with the idea of another way to bring people in and to facilitate them and help them. So there are several different things we would do like that, you know, from the cooking classes to, which was going on in those days, to the dojo, or the Martial Arts Institute. The idea was, what are some pious areas, or what are some dharmic things that can be done to help connect people, you know, with the North and the Dharma. So now you all have to think of ways how to make it happen. It's a little more complex now because now we're working out of Madhava's house. This is really, and his children are smaller, and like we're here, and this is really someone's house. This is Madhava and Kanti's home. These two deities are here, I live here, so we say Institute still. The basic Institute was a functional place where few people lived, and it was ongoing people coming in and coming out. We are in our heyday. And it was nice because it was where people could just come in from lunch, I mean, come in at lunch break and come and take prasadam and go back to work. Or they didn't have a car, they could come by public transportation. You know. And then once that we were renting that building, once we lost that building, their motto was so graceful. But at the same time, we were making a transition to Gitanagari. So we took some of the boys to Gitanagari and we got a place there, the house I live in now. And Madhava, who had, you know, just recently gotten married, just said, he had always told me once in passing, just very lightly in his soft voice, he said, well, maybe I could offer my house to the Institute. So I just considered maybe he would, you know, a room we would use to set up an altar and we could, you know, function like that. And he had showed me, we drove by once and he showed me this vacant area in Harwood, which was just like a forest. Mm-hmm. He said, you're going to build a house here. So it was in the back of my mind, and I forget all about it. So just around the time we were ready to move, Madhava had completed his house. And so, and those of you know, he had this big house he had built on, I think, 6 acres of land. So then when we got moved away from the Institute on in the Capitol Hill area, then we shifted, and him and his family just had 2 rooms. Then we had the whole, you know, whole big house. It was a really nice facility. But the difficulty was, it would take almost an hour for most people to get there. So there we had now our own building. Well, Madhava's house was his house, but our own facility. But far away, we built the whole basement into the temple area and everything. A lot of rooms. But only the most loyal people would come, practically. So it got to a point, it was almost like the Institute now had just become the initiated Institute devotees who were coming, you know, for the programs and coming to do deity service. We were there for several years. And then later we realized that we need to come back into the city. So we had 2 other places, you know, from that. And then Madhava rented a place because he bought the property and Gidanagri was going to build there. Then due to the needs of his children having to have special education, he had to stay. And so then he bought this house. And we're using this. So as we build up again, then we should be able to get a facility, or even buy a facility, or rent a facility that's more available for people to come and doesn't put the tax, you know, on their family like this also. Anyways, this is part of the history of some of the dynamics of the Institute.
Anyone like to ask a question before I? Because Laurie asked a question.
Please.
I think over 10 years ago.
Maybe hold here because they're trying to record.
Over 10 years ago. I think it was about 10th of Eid, and I think there was a Krishna Consciousness Institute there.
Okay.
And I think I saw this book called Spiritual Warrior.
Okay.
And the only thing that hit me out of it is about this life is an illusion.
Okay.
And
that's good. That's the biggest thing.
It's been like just gnawing at me ever since then. Yeah. I've never sat down and got into it and stood.
Yeah.
Just a year ago, I was checking out some Buddhism. So a little card said, everything is illusion. Mm-hmm. You want to end pain and suffering, understand that everything is illusion.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'd like you to speak on that a little bit more, mm-hmm. Because it's like, it seemed like, I don't quite understand that,
mm-hmm.
but it seems like it's something that just gnawing at me to get an understanding of that, because if we see this, it seems like it would be like an epiphany, if I'm saying the word right,
mm-hmm.
or a paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm.
So for someone who's just trying to understand it, I mean, everybody here is this illusion I'm looking at,
mm-hmm.
and how do you do that swift in perspective, mm-hmm. and flow with it comfortably? Where this came from, so you don't seem like you're
okay.
Crazy.
Okay. Yeah. I think this is your first time here visiting us, isn't it?
Here.
Yeah, we're really happy that you're here and amazed at your questions and, you know, your concerns. First, it shows how a little seed can plant and can grow later. Now, the illusion is just as we're reading this meditation, it's talking about the body. And that life is so much connected with air or with prana, that the body, it's temporary,
mm-hmm.
is the garments we have.
Mm-hmm.
So we may put on a black coat one day, or a red coat, or a white coat, or a pair of blue jeans, or a pair of slacks. Mm-hmm. And we go inside of that, and we use it. Mm-hmm. It's like walking into a building or into a car. Now, some people have the tendency to think that they are the car.
Mm-hmm.
You lean on it, they get angry. Get off me. And some people think that they're the clothes, and some people think that they're the clothes, the skin.
Mm-hmm.
So the same way, it's just as we use the clothes, and yes, it's a part of us, and we even get influenced by the clothes we have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you feel a certain way, you put on a suit. You feel another way, you put on a pair of jeans. But another way, you put on a pair of shorts.
Of course.
You put on a pair of sweatshirts, shirt and pants. So although that influences you, but you're not that. Mm-hmm. You're something that's using it. Mm-hmm. The illusion is people are thinking that they are the bodies when they're using the bodies. See, the soul is really the real essence or the life force. Mm-hmm. And the soul is neither European, American, African, Indian, etc. It's the soul that is using the garment, mm-hmm. an African garment or European garment. Mm-hmm. So similarly, all matter, whether it's the matter of our bodies, mm-hmm. of our car, or other kind of material facilities, mm-hmm. they're all being used mm-hmm. by the entity. Mm-hmm. According to one's consciousness, determines how he or she is using it. Mm-hmm. So the illusion is thinking that all of those physical things is in fact the all in all. Mm-hmm. And making life, as we were reading in the meditation, mm-hmm. is focusing on just trying to improve the other physical things. Because all those physical things, we only have for a while. Mm-hmm. And when we die, we are born without them, we come in the world with nothing, and we leave with nothing. Mm-hmm. So the illusion mm-hmm. is so much thinking that this is all that there is. Okay. Take one or two last questions, then we stop. It's getting really kind of late.
That's beautiful.
Thank you. Let's jot around your first name.
Oh, okay.
Marge, I was listening last week. You spoke about the emphasis on focus, and in particular, when we talk about, you also mentioned in the four principles of community that the way we relate in the present with other devotees is going to. We should also be understanding that situation is going to be the time of death, in terms of how our relationships, the way we're at now is what we should also be considering about that. Would you address the principle of focus and priorities in a devotee's life? Some people say God, family, country, or a job, and would you speak about the importance of that in a devotee's life?
Yeah, that principle of that, you know, what we do, what you put energy into, you're going to get more of. So the idea is the kind of association you have every day is going to have a big influence on your consciousness, what you imbibe. And the way you take advantage of community will have an effect on your own level of enthusiasm and determination. You associate with devotees who are weak, who are blasphemous, or who are hypocrites, then more than likely you will also begin to accept some of that or become, you know, like such. Associate with devotees who are dosha darsi, who are doubtless and fearless and determined, very eager to try to grow, then you will also pick up, you know, that as part of your consciousness. So one should always look and pursue association that will be exhilarating in that way, and try to become that higher association for others if possible. And that will come back to you as well. And being focused, it's very simple. It's just when we have anything that we really want and we've really accepted that it's valuable to us, it's easy for one to become more determined and trying to be a part of that or attain that. We just have to have greater appreciation of the importance of spiritual life. And then we will become much more eager and determined, you know, to attain the goal. So I think we'll stop here. So just keep in mind, we just looked at how you can look at disease in many ways, you can look at life in many ways. And to have life, Panachayasi Hetu Pachar, that Siddhanta mentions about, you have to have life to preach. And real life, as we understand more and more you know, what the illusions are, real life means that we are able to touch the life of others and bring quality to the environment. And that the breaths that we are taking, that in each of those breaths or the things that we do, that is something that we can be excited that we're offering to Guru and to Krishna. So we're looking at life as being so many breaths, and going through a close investigation of kala, of time, and how when we are engage properly spiritually, then whatever happens in the future, we're okay and we're excited, because time for us is our friend. And when we are not doing things proper or having so many much procrastination or anarthas or sins in our lives, bijas or papa bij, then our future is kind of frightening to us, because what will happen and what can happen in the future can be very inauspicious. We all have the power, like Dhruva Maharaj. We have the ability, the prana within us, to not only influence our immediate environments, but influence the whole planet. As we become more aware and more sensitive, and allow ourselves to become empowered, then the prana of the conscience within each of us can have a bigger impact on the world. In the day societies when so many people in prominent positions have a lower consciousness, they're bringing down, you know, the world. They're bringing more social degradation. There is a need for conscious raising. It all starts, of course, with ourselves. Confound the child, that's it for Bhad.
Another Kishore? Internet access in your... I have...